Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Under the Rock Studios in Los Angeles, California, this is The Strange Chameleon Show, a podcast with style, soul, and sarcasm, along with laughter, love, and listen! Follow them now on iTunes. I promise, you won't, I mean, you will be entertained.
Hello, hello. Are you going
to
say something?
Hello, welcome to the Strange Chameleon Show. Oh, boy. Oh, yes.
I liked your stomping. What you were just doing.
You like that little stomp action?
Yeah, the stomp action.
Oh, boy. What a show we have for you tonight.
We have Ken Atkitty. He is a literary manager, producer, author. He is in the building and he will be joining us shortly, so please stay tuned. If you guys want to know how to sell your scripts, how to make it happen, how to live your dream, and if you're a storyteller, is even better. So stay tuned. Oh my gosh, you have two mics.
We got two mics here because I'm the engineer, right? All right, so okay. I need all the mics in the world happening.
Yeah, meanwhile I only have one. You got the mic that is that the SM72?
7B, actually.
Oh, sorry, I'm reading
it. 7B.
I'm reading it upside down.
Yeah.
I thought it was.
It was the 7B. Yeah, this is the famous mic that
Joe Rogan uses.
Joe Rogan, a lot of other new podcasters and existing ones.
So you just wanted to show off.
I picked it up and I wanted to kind of see what it sounded like.
Okay, yeah. Okay, sounds good. Well, what a beautiful day, almost.
Yeah.
Looks all white and drabby, right? It was a beautiful, beautiful past few days ever since the rain stopped, I mean. And then
right.
The sun came out, it was beautiful. And then you got these planes spraying, just tagging the sky,
And yeah,
now
it's
all
sad.
What? Marine layer. Yeah, right. Anyways.
Right. Well, they control the air.
Anywho.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? You can't seem to control something. You can't seem to control yourself. Humming at work.
What are you talking about?
I don't know, you guys, but
what do you do?
For me, it's a little annoying when I hear others humming at work. But what do you?
You got to whistle while you work. You know.
So you like to hum?
I hum. I sing. I do a lot of different things, but no, there's this time at work where I was kind of like, I got this stupid song stuck in my head because it's like the Christmas theme, you know?
Okay.
Kind of, but I was like humming kind of faintly, just very quietly, you know? And then the guy that I work with, you know, he's just really involved, you know? So he's kind of like, hey, what are you humming? Hey, what are you singing there? You know? And I'm just like, Miracles by Mariah Carey. I don't know. I just
awkward.
Had to, and he's like, oh, and it kind of sounded like something else, like a man song he referred to.
He said that.
And I was
I thought it was a man song.
No, he didn't say it was a man song, but he said something else, and I forgot the artist that he thought I was singing.
And
I was like, oh,
Lil
no.
Somebody.
Yeah. Sorry.
Everyone has these little names.
Lady Gaga or something. You know, all these stupid songs just corrupt my mind and then I start singing it. It's crazy.
You know who seems to be corrupted?
Ooh.
No, I'm just kidding. No, people are claiming that Kevin Hart is now this terrible person because, did you hear? He got kicked out of hosting the Oscars.
What? No.
Yeah, apparently someone by the name of Benjamin Lee, who works for the New York Post, I think. Don't quote me on that, but Benjamin Lee for sure is his name. This guy has way too much time on his hands. Okay, he went on his Twitter account and he dug up tweets from 2011. You know how long that takes to go back in time and dig up someone's old tweets? So the purpose of him for doing that is, so he found some quote unquote dirt about all these like homophobic jokes he was making and this and that. I mean, that was so long ago. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think? Should he had been ousted as the host for...
No, that's kind of an extreme for something that happened so long ago, and they're bringing that up. Oh, no. He should still be at the, you know, hosting the Oscars.
Yeah. Well, Michael Che defended Kevin Hart on his SNL bit. He questioned, didn't the Academy nominate Mel Gibson for an award just last year? End quote. And I don't know, does that beg
burn.
The question? Does that beg the question? But at least, you know, like, we forgave Mel. That's the whole point. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We forgave him, but why did we... First of all, he was... he seems like a really cool guy.
Kevin Hart?
No, Mel Gibson.
Mel Gibson, okay.
He's such a creative mind, you know what I mean? And I don't think there's anyone disputing that, but just don't hand him a drink, okay?
Right.
Just don't. But, you know, he went through his thing. He's okay now. He's sobered up. He's doing all right. We forgave him. So why can't we forgive Kevin Hart? Why? Is it because he's black?
Oh, maybe. I don't know.
It's a real question. Because why is it that we can get over Mel Gibson doing what he did, but not Kevin Hart? You know? It's so long ago. He said he was sorry. He said, you know what? If I'm going to be judged by my past, you know, just get out.
Right.
Those weren't his exact words, but he did make the point, you know, like, don't judge someone by what they've done in the past. Like, if you can't believe that that people can grow, you must be living in a really small world.
Right.
So anyways, it just seems so unfair.
I agree. No, I mean, it seems like just networks and everybody's just kind of cracking down on like the simplest things. You do something wrong, so minuscule, and all of a sudden they'll just cut your arms off and just be so dramatic and kick you out of things.
Cut your arms off.
Yeah. Just being so dramatic and like, oh my gosh, to the extreme.
Oh my gosh, to the extreme.
To the extreme.
Well, when you're messing with someone's livelihood, like their work, I do think that is pretty extreme. Just saying.
There you go.
But today I had the privilege of being able to nominate. I'm in the nominating committee for the Screen Actors Guild Awards. It was a hassle, I tell you.
Oh my gosh.
I got kicked out of that site 3 times.
Did you?
I almost gave up. But then I thought about the wonderful studios that sent me. I was flooded in screeners. And I mean flooded with screener DVDs. And then I thought about them and I'm like, okay, they didn't just send me all this stuff for nothing. You know what I mean? I got to go through it. But I almost gave up because it's like 3 times I got booted out and then I got to start all over.
Log back in.
Yeah, it was just like, oh man. But okay. I got my little pamphlet. I got my little pamphlet.
Oh, great. Nerd.
I kid you not, Jennifer Garner in Peppermint, she was amazing.
Yeah?
She was awesome, and I know people are going to be laughing, and I don't care, but I really feel like her performance went unnoticed. I don't know why. But Nicole Kidman in Destroyer...
Yeah.
Wow. I'm not going to tell you who I nominated, but I'm just going to say that Nicole Kidman's transformation and performance in Destroyer.
Yeah, I saw that movie as well. A little bit of it.
Yeah.
Actually, I think we saw the whole thing, yeah. And it was great.
Well, actually, you sneaked to watch it a little bit because you aren't allowed to watch it. So you sneaked in a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, but remember, I was able to take you as a guest for one of the screeners, and that was great.
That's true.
Yeah. And
thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome. But anyhow, what? Why do you look at me with this blank stare?
No, I don't have this blank stare. I'm just, we have a great guest for tonight.
Yeah, I already said that. Why do you sound so... You sound like such a square right now.
I'm not a square. I am a acute triangle. Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, basically, we have a great guest, and he will be in shortly.
Okay, do you want to go get him?
I got to do everything around here. Smithers.
Let's go ahead and get Smithers on the line.
Oh, boy.
I think we should bring him back.
Here we go. Yay, there he is.
Hello, Ken. How take a doing? Seat. We're doing great. Thank you. Go ahead and take a seat.
Okay.
Thank you for being here.
He's going to take a seat. Just take it easy, all right? He's going to sit down. Yes.
All right. Okay, kind of got it. Well, that sounds like fun. hello.
Thank you. Welcome to the Strange Chameleon Show.
Thank you. You guys are amazing.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much. You are too. We know that you've been in the business for quite some time. And why don't you go ahead and tell us why you got started in the business and what drew you in?
Well, I got started because it's a story business, and I was a professor teaching about stories for years, and realized that what I was doing is analyzing stories and criticizing stories and reviewing stories, but I wanted to be on the side of making stories and selling story, developing stories, selling stories, producing stories. Mm-hmm. So I came up with the project that ended up making a segue between my being a professor and being a producer, literary manager. And ever since, that's what I've been doing, living in the other world of stories, the real world, you know, the commercial stories,
yeah.
The story marketplace.
Was this a position you just kind of developed, or is it something that is already in the business? Like,
well, I didn't know what I was doing when I started. I started with a bunch of movies that I created.
Right.
And got lucky. And then I came back to Los Angeles after producing them in Canada. And realized that what I could be was a literary manager.
Gotcha.
I'd never heard of that term before. And now I'm got an apprentice I'm working with. He's apprentice to me, and he said he had never heard of it before. I said, well, neither did I when I started. And basically, literary manager is like an agent, but the difference is literary managers can produce movies. And agents can't do that. They,
gotcha.
They just sell.
Mm-hmm.
So it was perfect. It allows me to have management over a story without having an enormous capital fund to acquire stories with. And that was perfect because as a former professor, I didn't have an enormous capital fund to start with. So that's how I got into the management business. And managers produce movies. So I've sold hundreds of projects and produced 30-some movies.
Wow.
To date. And it's been, you know, nonstop fun.
And you were behind The Meg.
I was behind The Meg, yes.
Mm-hmm. The Meg.
With Jason Statham.
As Steve Helton has said many times, 50 people had turned it down until
wow.
he found us. And I told him that I loved the concept, but it needed a lot of development, which he signed up for with our Writers Lifeline company. And we spent about 3 months redeveloping the story, and then we ended up selling it for over $2 million to Doubleday as a book, and over $1 million to Disney as a movie. It was originally going to be a Disney movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, we were the very first producers involved.
Wow, that's awesome.
That is fantastic.
It was a long time ago, though. It takes a while to get a movie made.
Yeah.
And it was over 20 years ago.
Oh, wow.
When it started down the road.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Yeah, that is a long time.
And you just got some good news.
Yeah, we were just hearing the rumors that the sequel is being authorized and would appear in 2020.
So it just got greenlit.
Yeah, I wouldn't use the word greenlit yet, but it's in the works. Let's put it that way.
There, you just got word.
Yeah, you just got the first word.
Wait a minute. Yes. We just got word.
Exactly.
It's one of those things.
Yeah. Well, you heard it first here on the Strange Chameleon Show. So for people that love the Meg, that's good news.
Yeah, a lot of people did. I was just thrilled.
Yeah?
You know, they love Jason, and they love the little dog, and they love the little girl.
Yeah, well, Chameleon here, he's a big fan of Jason. He's a great actor, and he does adventure films quite well. He knows how to be in those action films, and he's incredible.
The Transporter was my favorite.
Yeah.
One and two.
And he has a way of being human about it all.
Yeah.
You really buy it. And he doesn't take himself too seriously. You know, that scene where he takes off, where she sees him with his shirt off, is just a very cool scene. Like, she's so flummoxed, she doesn't know what to do, and you know, she can't handle it.
Yeah. Well, I can't handle it either. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, about a week ago, we had Marcus Redman on, and he's a writer as well, and he mentioned how, you know, he's a believer like yourself that you can write a screenplay in just a matter of weeks. You're a believer of that. You can write a screenplay in about a week. Right.
You know, I used to give a course at UCLA for years called Write Your Story in 10 Weeks or Less or something like that. Or I think I said it in a week. Yeah, I said it in a week.
Mm-hmm.
That was the name of it. And but there is a catch 22 to it. One of my first books about writing, The Writer's Time, says that you'll never have writer's block if you make a simple rule. Never sit down to write until you know what you're going to write before you sit down.
Okay.
And in other words, never face a blank screen. Never fumble for words. Just figure out your story. So when I gave that course, the rule was whatever you've already written about your story, you have to turn it in to me immediately, which I did. I collected it all, and then I threw it all in the trash.
Okay.
And I said, now what's going to happen is for the next 5 weeks, it was a 10-week course, so I had to make it last that long. For the next 5 weeks, you're going to simply think about your story and tell me a little bit about it each week until we both believe it's a great story. But you're not allowed to take any notes or write anything down. Because here's what happens. If the human brain writes something down, it becomes very defensive about it and protective, and it doesn't want to change it. It wants to use it no matter what. It wants to use it. If you don't write it down, you don't have that problem. And people might say, what if I come up with a great idea but I forget it the next day? Well, then guess what? It probably wasn't a great idea.
Gotcha.
So you just stick with the good ideas, because they're the ones that go from day to day. And you walk along the beach, or you drive through traffic, or do whatever you do, and keep thinking about your story. You know, it's got to be about a character, and it's a character who's on some kind of a mission, and he's got to have an arc, and he or she's got to have a opponent, an antagonist, and they have to have
protagonist,
an arc and all of that. And when you get all that stuff straightened out, you start seeing the scenes of your story. And once you've seen all the scenes of your story, and you can pitch the story to yourself or to whoever you're working with, then you can sit down. And then it doesn't take really more than maybe 3 or 4 days to type it all out.
Gotcha.
Because ideally, in that creative process, you're typing out stuff you've already got figured out in your head. It's automatic writing.
I see.
Once somebody asked William Saroyan, who wrote one of the great American novels, and they said, "Is it true you wrote it in 3 days?" And he said, "No, actually, it took me all my life to write it. I just typed it out in 3 days." And that's what you want to get to as a writer, because you don't want to be working out characters on a page. You want to work them out in reality. And the test of them being worked out is that they haunt you. Mm. William Faulkner said that when he started a book, he started with a scene that haunted him and made him ask a bunch of questions. He gave an example from a very famous novel of his. He said, I just kept dreaming about a young girl in a fig tree with dirty pants looking through the window at a funeral. And I just started, you know, that scene haunted me, and I let it haunt me, and I started asking questions like, how did she get up in the tree?
Right. Well,
because it was a fig tree that she'd been climbing since she was a little kid, so being in a tree was natural to her. Mm-hmm. How did her pants get muddy? Because her brother Jason, you know, pushed her down in the creek, and she ran away and got in the tree. And whose funeral was it? Well, it was the funeral of her grandfather, you know, Compson. And this was the opening scene, the scene that drove The Sound and the Fury.
Oh, okay.
And but he let all these things haunt him, meaning didn't write them down until he had figured out the story. And once he figured out the story, then writing it was much easier. You know, so writing and composing are two completely different things. Mm-hmm. Writing is a mechanical process. Composing is the real creative process.
I know that Sylvester Stallone, he wrote out, had his wife type it out, the Rocky screenplay, in a matter of days. But he did say that he had been ruminating the story in his mind for several years.
Yeah, gestating it. Long time. I used to have a client who we sold, I think, 9 of his screenplays, and he's now producing a series that he's writing for television. And he could write a screenplay. He'd pitch it to me, and then he would write it, and he could write it in 3 or 4 days.
Wow.
And I told him, look, John, you cannot ever admit to anyone that you're doing it. Because, I mean, the Writers Guild requires that you have at least 8 weeks to do a revision on a draft, and that you have 16 weeks to do the
first
draft,
yeah,
and so on. And if you tell people that, you know, you won't be able to get the price that you're looking for if you tell them it only took you a few days to do this. And it took him a hard, long time, because he would say, you know, they'd say they want revisions, and he would say to me, like, he'd pass a note to me, like, well, I have them by Monday, and I go, no. And he would say, do you think you could get them in 6 weeks? And he would roll his eyes like, I don't really want to take 6 weeks to do this. I, you know,
right?
I can write another 2 stories and then 6 weeks.
Yeah, I know.
But it's true. It's all about, a good storyteller knows how to tell a story, and once he's get it, you know, has enough trust in his own process to not write things down, then he can. Doesn't take him that much time to do it. He figures it out, and then he writes it down.
And you're saying that, you know, once a scene or something, the story itself haunts someone, after they finally write it down and get it all on the paper, and then it starts, you know, doing its process, does it still haunt them? Or is it kind of like a release at that point, and then they're like, oh, great.
Yeah, it stops haunting them when they've got it all written down.
Right. It just doesn't keep staying there. Okay.
Yeah. And I'm, you know, my first book was all about the creative process, and just another thing is that people get what I call postpartum depression after they write a book or a script. And they don't have to get that. If they think about their process and what happens and know that that feeling of abandonment occurs, there's a simple way to avoid it entirely, which is to, as John did, it is to start another story before you finish this one. So, like, when you know that you've only got another 30 pages to write or another whatever, you stop and start the story that's percolating in the back of your mind.
Okay.
And you suddenly will start looking forward to doing that story, and then you can have no problem completing the first story. There are a lot of people have a problem of never being able to finish something, and it's because they're afraid of the comedown that occurs if they don't you know, prepare themselves by figuring out the next story first.
Mm-hmm.
But also, and there are people who, and I've been guilty of this, that believe that you have to have it all together to write it down. But that's not you. That's not necessarily true. It's just, it's kind of your mind holding you back in a way.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean, because that's kind of what I'm saying, is that you should know the whole story before you write it down. You don't necessarily have to know how it ends, but you do know have to know the situation, you know, the trouble that the character finds herself in, and the trajectory by which she will go and through that quest and try to get out of, you know, whatever, you know, problem she's involved with.
Yeah, figure out all the obstacles.
But you may not know the ending, but because once you start putting it down, the ending will suddenly appear before you, and that's when the character is coming alive. When people say the characters come alive, you know, and then they just tell you what to write. That's if you allow them to.
Mm.
But if you put everything on paper, you know, prematurely, you don't give them a chance to live. You know, it's your brain making them do certain things, and the magic doesn't happen that way. The magic happens when the characters are kind of dictating to you what their fate is going to be.
I see.
Interesting. Yeah. And you have said you've touched base on the ability of people like artists that should quit their jobs and just live the dream.
Yeah.
What's your advice on people that are thinking of doing that? Because that's a huge leap.
I'm one of them. I'm going to quit everything right now.
Don't quit your radio show. No, it's one of my books is called Quit Your Day Job and Live Out Your Dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And because that's what I did. I quit a tenured professorship and did went from the most secure job in the world to the least secure job in the world. And it was crazy, definitely crazy. But I always like to quote Salvador Dali, who said, "The difference between myself and a madman is that I am not mad." And that's an interesting statement. You know, it's Shakespeare called it method in your madness. You have to have a method, and that's what my book is about, is the method of taking, you know, this big creative leap. And I think that's the only way to happiness. I think if you're not doing that, you're following somebody else's dream. And if you are doing it, you know, you're not going to look back and regret that you didn't have enough money on last Tuesday when you were in the shopping mall. You're going to look back and wish that you had done, you know, that you'd follow your dreams. Because at the end of the day, that's how people measure themselves, is, you know, they end up kind of being disappointed at the end of their lives because they didn't do that, or they end up being feeling fulfilled and not being afraid of, you know, whatever comes next.
Mm-hmm.
I always loved, because people asked me if I had retired when I was 45 and left the academic world, and I said, no, I'm a follower of Benjamin Franklin, who said, "There's nothing wrong with retirement as long as it does not interfere with a man's dreams."
I like that.
You know, and that's the way it's always been for me.
And people that don't take that leap, it seems like when they reach that age of retirement, or even when they're in the workforce, a lot of them have this motto almost as that goes same S, different day. You know, it's just this repetition of
exactly
nothing. I mean, emptiness, and they're so unhappy.
Exactly, and. To this day, despite the fact that I'm managing 100 different projects, I get that feeling too occasionally, and I have to do something different. What I usually do is travel. I just got back from 2 weeks in Italy, and, you know, traveling wakes everything up again and makes me think of a bunch of new projects. And I have to balance between my own projects and the ones that I manage and produce. But the fact that I have to do that is actually, you know, the joy of my life. I mean, I get to do what a lot of people would really give their, you know, right arms to do. But there's nothing stopping them.
Right.
You know, there's
just
nothing stopping them, especially in this country of all places, where creativity is encouraged, and especially in Los Angeles, where mm-hmm. it really is a city of dreams.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody ever looks surprised when you tell them what your dream is in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the other parts of the country, if you're in the Midwest, they're worried about that. You know, one time I gave a class, and I said to the people in the class, it was a class on call, maintain your creativity, or, you know, keeping your creativity alive. And I said, please tell me the question you hate to hear the most when you're out socially, and how do you answer it? And one actress said, the question I hate to hear the most is, when are you going to move back to Detroit and work in the post office?
Hmm.
I said, oh, my God, that's terrible.
Yeah.
And I said, how do you answer that? She goes, usually I burst into tears and leave the room.
Oh, man.
And I said, well, we need to work on that response. And then I asked another actress in the class, what about you? And she said, the question I hate to hear most is, what have you been in big lately that I've seen? And I said, gee, that's terrible, too. I've had mm-hmm. that question many times. Now I can say the Meg, right?
In your face.
But she said, what I say is the Pacific Ocean.
and I said,
you see, this is the difference between learning how to live with your dream and not having learned that yet.
Yeah.
You know, because you know that people are going to say things and they're mm-hmm. going to, you know, cause you grief. And it's not necessarily because they're evil. They're just thoughtless.
Right. Insensitive a little bit.
Yeah, insensitive. Yeah. And so you need to prepare yourself before you go to a party for that question and have an answer like she did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody stopped, burst into laughter, and completely forgot the question because they really aren't interested anyway.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, you they know? Don't really care.
No, but, so, but they say yeah. it because it's a way of pigeonholing you immediately mm-hmm. and putting you in your place or figuring out who you are. So
to me, it seems also like because someone is young and dares to go after their dreams, other people, especially if they're, like I said, at that stage where it's the whole same as different day, they kind of envy that a little bit, I feel like. So they're trying to, like you said, you know, put you
sure.
down a little bit. And
yeah, you're doing what they're afraid to do.
Right.
And they want to hear that you're not happy.
Mm-hmm. You know, like them.
Yeah.
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 They do. I mean, I remember that my colleagues at Occidental College when I left were not very happy about it because I was giving up tenure, which, of course, everyone was holding on to and fighting for, and they couldn't believe it. So, I mean, I kept a few friends, but a lot of people just turned away or made, you know, I'll never forget it. One farewell party that I gave at my house for everybody, one old faculty member who I loved came up to me and goes, well, how does it feel to be an immoral producer? The next morning I had the perfect answer, kind of exactly the way it felt to be an immoral professor. But I don't remember what I said to him at the time. But that was kind of, you know, people try to put you down by a flip comment.
Yeah.
And looking down their nose at something they don't understand.
Right.
And there's a strange thing about doing a visionary profession. People don't get it who aren't committed to vision themselves. They just don't get it because they think that vision isn't real. And the truth is, vision is the only way that reality is created.
Oh, okay.
When you think about it, right? Like he had seen a headline in the trades that said that my project was being offered to the studios and that it was going to go forward in the next year. And it was, you know, it was headlines. And he asked me if that was true. And I said, well, that depends on what you mean by true. I believe it's true, and I'm going to make it happen. And he said, in other words, it's just hype, and it's not true.
I thought,
I don't know how to answer that exactly. But on Monday, a few days after the party, Warner Brothers made a deal with me that ended up being 16 movies. And suddenly it was true. And so I suddenly realized that the difference between, and he was kind of saying, so you're like a con man, he was kind of saying. You know? And I said to myself on Monday, the difference between a con man and a visionary in Hollywood is success.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise they're the same thing, right? You call him a con man if it didn't work out.
Mm-hmm.
you know, or it hasn't worked out yet.
Right.
He's a crazy guy. The guy doing paintings in his garage down the street is just the village embarrassment, right? But then when his first painting sells for $1 million, you go, oh, man, I always knew he was a genius.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Then they change.
Yeah.
Did you call that guy right after, though? You'd be like, hey, hey, you know.
No, I know. I don't really get a lot of joy out of saying, I told you so.
Yeah, I know. I think it's best if you're, when you have a smart comment back, like something more positive and or maybe humorous, I think that's kind of good in a sense because it kind of just like makes them smile and they're like, oh, okay. And then they'll just tune it out. But then the next day when something actually does happen, they turn around and be like, wow,
yeah,
actually.
He never apologized. You know, he knew it changed, that things changed. But
things changed.
He didn't apologize because... Why? Because he didn't really mean it that seriously or take it that seriously. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. You know, what an uncle told me years ago, don't worry about that much in life because, you know, you don't worry about what people think because, number one, they don't think that much.
Yeah.
And number two, they don't think about
you
that much.
They talk a lot, though.
Yeah. But they do when there's several people around with nothing to do. They'll talk about it. But they don't really think about you all the time.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's kind of a relief. It's like when you think about it, it gives you freedom to be yourself.
Right.
And truth be told, if someone is going to disrespect you in any way, there are people that make fun of others with disabilities, etc. It's not really them. It's, you know, that person is not the problem. It's that individual being disrespectful because they were going to be disrespectful regardless whether you look a little funny or not. It's an internal issue.
Yeah, it is. And well, I'm always telling my wife, because she runs a company that I'm in love with about giving back for the gift of yoga. I'm always telling her when she's worried about somebody having not responded or I always remember the rule, it doesn't have anything to do with you. Mm-hmm. I think mostly when people are acting strange, it's not about you at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's about something going on in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that there's just nothing sane except pursuing who you want to be. Nothing is stopping you from doing that.
Staying focused.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what are a few tips that you can give for treatments or, excuse me, for books that can become films?
Well, I used to give a course called Designing Your Novel to Be a Film because I found after I signed somebody to be a client and they were doing, you know, book after book and they were usually starting with the lament that their books that had not been picked up as films yet, you know, I would say, let's design this from the beginning. Your next book, let's design it as a film. So recently somebody right here in the San Fernando Valley had a great true story. It's called Nobody Walks, and it was a story about an attorney himself who went underground in the valley here in the world of drugs and porno to track down and bring to justice the killers of his brother.
Wow.
And I said, this is such a great story that, you know, it should be a film, but let's design the book to be a film from the beginning. And, you know, films have three acts. They have clear protagonists, and they have clear antagonists. So let's decide who the protagonist is here and who the antagonist is, and let's, you know, design it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So sure enough, when it was done, you know, we sold it to a publisher, and now it's set up at MGM with the director attached, and my partner is Mark Platt Productions, which, you know, who they are, Into the Woods and
nice.
Legally Blonde and, you know, La La Land and so
on. Yeah.
And, but we just designed it that way so that it had all the qualities that we look for when we're trying to find a script or a book to, you know, to turn into a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Three acts, strong, you know, hero and strong villain, et cetera, and a satisfying and clear ending, and twists and turns and cliffhangers and all those things. No reason why you can't put those into a book.
Yeah.
And very few books actually follow that rule, but when you look at John Grisham, you know, or Stephen King, they know what they're doing. That's what they do.
Yeah.
And speaking of books, I know you're your latest book is, you brought it in here, Tell Your Story to the World and Tell It for Millions. And then there's another book.
Show the camera.
The Messiah
Hold
Matrix.
Hold up to the camera, yeah. Oh, yeah, there is a camera.
And the Messiah Matrix.
Yeah, we're developing the Messiah Matrix now as a mini-series, and I decided that the only way to get that done is to do the script. So one of the reasons I was in Italy is to finish the second episode script, and I'm going to do the third episode next, and it's a 5-episode mini-series that we're developing
that
for. And in this new book, Tell Your Story to the World and Sell It for Millions, the whole idea is to take somebody who I learned how to tell stories on the front porch in Louisiana, where I was born, from my uncles and cousins who were telling stories. And how do you get from that front porch into Hollywood is kind of the story, you know, the purpose of the book. So how to help a natural storyteller become a commercial storyteller. Because just because you can tell a story doesn't mean you can sell a story.
That's right.
And
right.
A lot of people think that, you know, that's all there is to it. But, you know, there are good storytellers and bad storytellers. I had one uncle who, the minute he started telling a story, everybody vacated the porch and, you know, headed off.
Stay away from the uncle's, you know, stories, yeah.
You know. But I had another one who, you know, the minute he started telling a story, everybody showed up with their coffee and wanted to listen.
Yeah.
So I started, you know, learning what makes a good storyteller, what doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is being able to, you know, see how their audiences are responding as they're telling the story, and being aware of that. And came over years of working with stories, I realized the most important character in a story is the audience. It's not the author, and it's not any of his characters. It's his awareness of the audience. And that's what made Stanley Kubrick or Alfred Hitchcock such incredible directors, because they were always exactly one step ahead of the audience, and they knew what the audience was wanting and needing. For example, in a horror movie like The Birds, you know, why does the heroine walk up the steps with a flashlight that she hasn't even tested into the attic where she hears some strange noises, right?
Right.
But that walk up the steps takes a long time, because he knows the audience has to go through the question I just asked and get okay with it. And as she finally reaches the top step, realize, this is why I came. To be scared out of my mind.
Right, right.
You know, because at the bottom, you're denying, at the bottom of the steps, you're denying, this is crazy, why is she wearing white underwear? Why, you know, why is the woman in Sigourney Weaver wearing white underwear at the end of Alien, you know? But you get through all that, and then you wait for what you paid for. And that's the psychology of the audience.
Hmm.
You know, understanding the audience as a character in your story, and you've got to stop and wait for them, or you won't give it the story the impact that it can have.
Steven Spielberg said that the audience is getting smarter.
Oh yeah, that's you know, you, the minute you see certain things in a movie, you know where it's going. So, you know, that's, you either, as comedy, there are kind of two rules of comedy: either set up expectations and fulfill them, or you set up expectations and defeat them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fine art to do either one of them in a way that can keep the present, you know, the contemporary audience entertained, because we're so savvy. We've seen so many stories.
Yeah.
I know there was a scene in Frozen Ground with Nicolas Cage, and the guy that played the villain, that was the secret murderer that was killing these girls in town, I knew it was him before it was discovered it was him. There was just a split moment where he walks into a bakery shop that he owned, turns around, and he licked frosting off his hands. But for some reason, that just told me everything. It was the way he did it. I could see the evil. Mm-hmm. It was very smart. And that was, I felt, the way that the director was telling us who it was, but you know what I mean?
Right. Without giving it all away.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Without giving.
That was exactly the director, you know, making the audience into a character in the story, because the audiences don't even articulate this, but your unconscious is saying, why are we watching that detail?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, unless he's the bad guy.
It was,
right.
It was a chilling moment.
Yeah.
Which was odd because someone's just in a bakery licking frosting off their hands. But there was something about it. So that, yeah, that one got me.
It's like Hannibal Lecter,
yes.
You know, licking his lips.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I would not want to see that across the dinner table. Or
yeah, I know. Huh?
Should go.
Well, yeah. So...
think it's time for
it's time, it's that time again.
The ventilator.
For the ventilator. Smithers.
What's your ventilator? What's your ventilator? What's your
Yeah, we were huge fans of the Power Rangers when we were kids.
Yeah,
and we still incorporate it as adults.
Yeah, we had to get a little savvy with it. What is something that is recently just a little frustrating, getting under your skin a little bit? Here's your chance to get it out.
Get it out. Release it.
Well, you said getting under my skin a little bit. I don't know if I can talk then.
Or a lot.
Something that really just pisses you off. You just want to just talk about it. And
we just got back from, you know, an airline trip, and airlines are airlines, and you know, but there's a huge difference between American Airlines and European Airlines or Asian Airlines. American Airlines have the worst service imaginable and the attitude. And so really what I would like to vent about is not just airline service, but the whole concept of service in this country. It used to be an important concept. I mean, it used to be up there with honor and duty and dignity and service.
Mm-hmm.
Now, honor, I guess, is out the window. And dignity, gone.
Yeah.
And duty... that's an archaic word, right?
Aside from stepping in it.
But unfortunately, with some glaring, wonderful exceptions, service is just horrible in this country. And the worst thing about it that really makes me crazy is that we take it.
Hmm.
You know, we put up with the worst service. Like going to any restaurant, almost, you know, you get bad service one way or the other. You either get an attitude, you know, oh, I'll see if I can find a seat for you. You don't have reservations? No, but I notice you have 25 empty tables.
I know.
We'll see what we can do, okay? Mm-hmm. And then they make you wait and so on. And just the idea that in Europe or Asia, service is a matter of pride. You know, they are there to serve you. And in Japan, where we go frequently, it's an art. I mean, you go to one of the biggest department stores, Takashimaya, and they used to have a woman at the bottom of every escalator with a pair of tongs and a basket full of kind of doilies. If anyone knows what a doily is anymore, little like white lace handkerchiefs.
Oh, okay.
And before you got on the escalator, she would put the handkerchief so you could hold it as you went up the escalator. And at the top, there was a lady waiting with a pair of tongs, and she would remove it and, you know,
dispose
toss it.
Of it. Yeah.
Dispose it into the laundry.
That's awesome.
And, you know, in Japan, taxi drivers wear white gloves, and they don't want you to touch the door because they don't want you to soil your hands. So the doors are all automatic.
And wow.
So the whole culture, and Europe is more or less the same way, is focused on making the customer feel happy, which actually used to be an American quality too.
Mm-hmm.
But we lost it. And I don't know why we lost it. Was it because of the unions who were focused on themselves instead of the customers? Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, you take an airline like United or, you know, even Delta or American, and sometimes you just want to get out of the way of the flight attendants because they are not, they have zero patience. You have a problem? You know, why are you talking to me about it?
Right.
You think you have problems?
Uh-huh.
You know, I have problems.
It just seems like people can't keep professional, can't stay professional. They can't separate their private life with their work life.
Well, and they don't understand the privilege of working and of actually serving. If you don't like serving the public, then, you know, quit your job.
That's right.
You know, mm-hmm. become an artist.
Yeah.
Chase the dream.
Yeah. We're all about customer service, and I agree. It's just going downhill, and we need to bring it back up.
And you know, Yelp is a good start toward that because I know it's kind of nasty to say that you had a bad experience at a restaurant or whatever, or wherever it is, you know, at the grocery store. But we need to do that. I think we should be responsible for doing that because it helps all of us.
I agree. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Yes,
point
thank you
made.
Very much.
You get something.
You get a prize.
Okay.
It's out of our bag of BS.
All right.
Beautiful selection.
There
okay.
you go.
For the fireplace.
Beautifully freshed from the trees, fallen fresh from a tree
wow.
in the park.
Pine cone.
A pine cone.
It even smells like a pine cone.
I told you it was fresh.
An unburned pine cone in California. That is excellent. Thank you.
Well, it's that time, kiddos. Thank you all for listening to the Strange Chameleon Show. Thank you so much.
Ken, for being
yeah,
here.
Thank you, Ken, for being on our show.
Thank you guys so much, Mariel and Patrick. It's great to be with you.
Tell your story to the world.
Thank you.
Sorry. And yeah, tell your story to the world. Thank you all for listening to the Strange Chameleon Show. Remember, put your thinking cap on and jam on!
Okay.
All right.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.